Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Lieutenant Colonel Todd Thompson served in the United States military for more than 20 years, which means his wife, Robin, was married both to Todd, the man she loved, and as the saying goes, she was married to the military, the organization Todd served. Todd was just 22 when he enlisted in 1995. He met Robin 2 weeks later, and his duties took him and sometimes Robin everywhere, from Pennsylvania and New Mexico to South Korea. And then, in 2007, Todd was stationed at Camp Victory in Baghdad.
I do remember him describing how, you know, really filthy the conditions were over there and how unpleasant it was. And I remember he used to go and write me a note on the dust on the floor of his barracks. And he would say hello today and take a picture and send it to me. And then he'd sweep all the dust out. And then the next day, because there was so much dust back, he would write me another message. So this was kind of like a little game that we would play.
The dust endlessly drifted in, both because of the dry conditions and because Todd's barracks were right next to the base's burn pits. Now, burn pits weren't anything Robin had given much thought to or had even heard of until 4 years later, 2011, when Todd was at home.
We were at home, we were both watching some TV, watching the news, and there was a story about burn pits coming on.
Giant burning trash piles, they're sometimes acres in size, that the military used to burn waste in Iraq and Afghanistan. These were the answer to how do you dispose of trash in a war zone when you can't just run down to the local landfill. Joining me now is Iraq and Afghanistan veterans of America.
And he goes, yeah, he says, when I was in Baghdad, my barracks were close to the burn pits and we had to go down one day and drop off some material to be burnt. And it's about 10 acres of just trash. And he said it was everything that you could possibly ever imagine. Everything.
Food, clothes, used medical supplies, cans of paint, plastic water bottles, batteries, tires, big screen TVs, and even entire Humvees too damaged by IEDs to salvage.
And they would set it off with jet fuel.
And breathing in those toxic fumes threatens to kill many more Americans than combat has.
And he said that black smoke was constantly coming out of the burn pits 24/7. And my reaction to it was like, wow, that doesn't sound very safe. Wonder what that's about. And in my mind, I couldn't imagine at the time that type of system operating could potentially harm our service members.
The U.S. military used burn pits for years. They're sometimes as large as 10 acres. They used them at many bases abroad, but especially in Iraq and Afghanistan. Clouds of black smoke from the pits would billow for miles, and pilots sometimes reported using the smoke as visual confirmation of a base's location. A survey from the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America finds that nearly 90% of post-9/11 veterans were exposed to the smoke from the burn pits. And that smoke was toxic. Robin Thompson didn't think much more about the burn pits after that night in 2011, until the next year, August 2012, when Todd got sick.
And he comes home and he goes, my stomach hurts. And he says, it's right above my belly button. He said, but if I stretch, you know what, it must be muscular. If I stretch it out, it feels a little bit better.
Todd was otherwise healthy. He exercised, ate well, never smoked, and only drank occasionally.
And we went from that to him being incredibly sick in the matter of 3 or 4 weeks, where he was in the hospital and the emergency department 3 times, and he was in excruciating pain. The third time he ended up in the emergency room, he was sent directly up to the hospital to be an inpatient. And then within 18 hours, he had surgery because they discovered what that thickening was cancer.
Todd was diagnosed with colon cancer. He was 39 at the time.
And he had chemo every single week for almost 3 years. And they brought in a biological medication too. The cancer that he had metastasized incorrectly too. It went through all the lining of his organs, his abdominal organs. So there was no opportunity for him to be able to survive that.
The diagnosis was terminal. But Robin and Todd couldn't understand how he could have developed such an aggressive cancer in the first place. So that took them to a specialist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
And I remember the oncologist saying, like, this is exposure. Like, you got exposed to something. Typically, due to industrial exposure, most likely benzene was one of the culprits. And we started thinking about what could he have been exposed to? Where could he have been? And it just always boiled down to the location of where he was when he was in Baghdad, close to the burn pits.
In fact, many soldiers have reported severe health problems after exposure to the burn pits on their bases. Respiratory distress, blood disorders, autoimmune diseases, all the way to rare forms of cancer like Todd. And for years, most of these veterans have fought unsuccessfully to receive health care coverage for medical expenses due to the burn pit exposure. In 2013, Todd and Robin gathered and filled out all the paperwork they needed and submitted his coverage claim to the Department of Veterans Affairs. They waited almost a year and a half for a response.
It's ridiculous. It was a ridiculous amount of time.
All the while, Todd got sicker, and his medical bills kept piling up.
The bills were expensive because there's some things that just don't get covered. And once we got into the world of having to use not only a chemo, but also a biologic, that's when things got really expensive. And there was no coverage from the VA at all. So things were tight. Things were tough for a long time. And we had a new house, a new baby, a toddler. And it was a tough time.
The VA finally responded. In February 2015, Todd's request for coverage was denied.
And at that time, I'm like, I can't deal with this right now. My husband's in hospice. I have two little kids. My husband's dying. Like, I cannot deal with this at this point.
Lieutenant Colonel Todd Thompson died 1 month later, March 13th, 2015. He was 42. Robin buried her husband, but she would not let the VA's denial go unanswered. She appealed the VA's rejection of Todd's coverage claim, and the VA said...
It said that they needed more paperwork, so I'm like, okay, that's fine. I can provide them with more paperwork. So I got literally every single stitch of paperwork from his hospitalizations, his surgeries, his oncologists, the specialists, the nutritionists that helped him with his TPN, his hospice care... And it was mounds of paperwork, and I took it to the VA to have them process it, and it still got denied.
As of March 2021, the VA had denied more than 70% of burn pit claims, according to an analysis by Military.com. Of more than 15,000 disability compensation claims related to burn pit exposure, only 3,500 veterans had at least one issue granted.
If you took my husband's story and just changed the name, that was the person I'm talking to next to me. It's just, it's the same exact template of how they were diagnosed and how it went and the difficulties and the struggles and lack of support from the VA. And it's the same exact story. And they're healthy people. They just have no explanation as to why they became this ill. It always boils down to burn pit exposure. That's been the common denominator.
But the VA sees it differently. The VA denied 40% of coverage requests because veterans could not report a diagnosed medical condition. Another 40% were denied because they were unable to connect their condition to their service. Again, according to that Military.com analysis. But all that may be changing. President Biden mentioned the issue in his State of the Union address last month. And on Tuesday of this week, at the Fort Worth VA clinic in Texas, Biden announced his administration's determination to expand access to health care for veterans exposed to burn pits.
The thing that bothers me the most when veterans aren't looked out for because of what we owe them is every single solitary veteran deserves to be treated with dignity. They shouldn't have to ask for a damn thing. It shouldn't be, can you help me? It's, I've got a problem, and we should say, how can we help?
Which is, of course, the opposite of what the government did for years. And in a biting, if unintentional, moment of irony, President Biden mentioned a similar struggle to gain health care coverage, a struggle by 9/11 first responders in New York who had rushed into smoke and debris at the World Trade Center following the very terrorist attack that led the U.S. military to invade Afghanistan and later Iraq, where soldiers years later were exposed to those burn pits.
You saw what happened in the, what happened when at 9/11 when the buildings went down in New York. You saw the thousands of firefighters who, in fact, were, because of the toxic smoke they inhaled, finally, because some of the people in the media and in entertainment insisted that they be compensated for.
The changes come too late for Lieutenant Colonel Todd Thompson. He left behind two daughters when he died, Andley, who's now 13, and Brinley, who's 10. On Sunday, his wife Robin and the girls will mark the 7th anniversary of Todd's death.
I want everyone to remember his life and that he served, but also to respect that his death was due to the fact that he did serve our country, and that people in his type of situation need to be honored and respected and taken care of just as much as someone who was killed in action or is 100% disabled. They need to be acknowledged. They need to be treated. They need to be respected because they also served our country. They just happened to bring the war home with them and died in a different way.
Robin Thompson, wife of the late Lieutenant Colonel Todd Thompson. She lives in Hamilton, Virginia. When we come back, we'll have a lot more about burn pits and legislation to help veterans, what it does and what it doesn't. But if you or someone you know is grieving the loss of a service member, the TAPS 24/7 National Military Survivor Helpline is available toll-free with support and resources at 1-800-959-TAPS. And if you've been exposed to toxic burn pits, you can also join the VA's Airborne Hazards and Open Burn Pit Register. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about burn pits, those vast garbage pits that the United States military used and uses in bases abroad that they set on fire and accelerate with jet fuel, and the health consequences that have come to thousands of U.S. soldiers and civilians surrounding the burn pits due to the toxic smoke. Now, I'd like to bring into the conversation Lieutenant Colonel Dan Brewer. He joins us from Albany, Georgia. He's a retired officer who spent 34 years in the Army. And in 2005, he was sent to Iraq by the Pentagon as an environmental officer. Lieutenant Colonel Brewer, welcome to you.
Good afternoon. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for joining us today. In 2005, when you went to Iraq, can you tell us what you saw burning in those pits?
Well, the first time I ever saw a burn pit, I went there to just see what was happening at the base, and I was just appalled. I saw a base that was closing. We were turning it over, and I went down this burn pit. Now, my background, I was an environmental auditor with Procter & Gamble, so I was used to looking at environmental problems. I went down in this pit. I saw, you know, remains of plastic that was burned and medical waste and syringes and unburnt ammunition. And my first thought was, is this even legal what we're doing? I said, oh, my Lord. I said, you know. And my initial thought was, this is going to come back and haunt us. I mean, that was my first time I ever saw a burn pit.
Mm. And was it smoldering at the time, or was it still burning, the first one you saw?
The very first one I saw was a base we were getting ready to turn back over to Iraqis. But, you know, I spent the first month going around to different bases looking at the situation. And eventually I saw, you know, burn pits in operation and saw that. Smoke and the smoldering and stuff. So I saw repeatedly that anything and everything was going in these burn pits, and a lot of stuff that should never, ever be burnt was just being thrown into the burn pits. And I saw the smoke and the fumes coming off this. And I started telling people immediately, I mean, this is going to get us in trouble.
Mm. Well, Lieutenant Colonel Brewer, let me just play a call that we got from one of our listeners, Rana from Cameron, Wisconsin, and she wanted to share with us her husband's experience serving in the Iraq War.
He flew those Blackhawks over many, many burn pits and would talk about, even with the respirators, how they couldn't breathe. And to this day, he still has problems with breathing, and things will smell strange. And honestly, the husband this country sent to Iraq is not the same husband for me that came home, and I mourn for those days when we were who we were.
That's On Point listener Rana from Cameron, Wisconsin. Lieutenant Colonel Brewer, you were sent to Iraq again in 2005 to assess. The DOD sent you there, right? To assess the conditions bases. And so your job was to report back. What happened after you did?
Well, I mean, people tried to shut me down. But I mean, my first conversation with a two-star general who asked me, had I ever been to combat before? I said, no, sir. Have you ever seen a burn pit before? No, sir. He said, then obviously you don't know what you're talking about. I said, I know a problem when I see a problem. He told me to keep my thoughts to myself, which I didn't. I started taking pictures, and I started showing these pictures. And eventually, they sent me back to the Pentagon, and I showed these pictures to a lot of people. I mean, and it was horrible what we were doing. And you know, I just, you know, during the surge, when the base camps grew, we started putting people all around these burn pits. So somebody was breathing these fumes at night, and a lot of the really, really bad stuff that had really black smoke mysteriously got burned at night when you couldn't see the black smoke. And that's when people were sleeping, breathing this stuff all night long. Mm. It's just a horrible practice.
So it sounds like you feel like your findings weren't taken seriously at all. I mean, would you go so far as to say, Lieutenant Colonel Brewer, that was the DOD just stonewalling every time you tried to say, hey, this is something we need to pay attention to?
Well, there was always a few pockets of people who listened to me, but it was personality driven. If you thought it was wrong, people listen. But if you didn't care, people blew you off. Okay. And because it wasn't, there was no regulations really when we started. I eventually wrote a regulation for contingency operations that got published in 2009. But, you know, to start with, people pretty much, you know, did what they thought was right or didn't do what they didn't want to do. And so it was based on people's personalities. And in a lot of cases, people just didn't care.
Huh. Interesting. Well, Lieutenant Colonel, stand by here for just a second, because I also want to note that we definitely reached out to both the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Pentagon as well with several questions about sort of what they knew about burn pits going back several years. They sent us back answers to those questions, including this from the Pentagon, who we asked them that there have been reports from inside the U.S. government of scientific studies dating back to the early 2000s, so even before you went to Iraq, Lieutenant Colonel, showing that burn pits could cause major health problems. Oh, this is from the VA, I should say, not the Pentagon. This is from the VA. And they pointed us to a report from May 2008 from the National Research Council. And it's a review of enhanced particulate matter in their surveillance program there. And they say that at that time, burn pits posed an acceptable or safe health risk to personnel stationed at Joint Base Balad in Iraq. And they also say that later in 2011, the Institute of Medicine put out a report called The Long-Term Health Consequences to Exposure of Burn Pits in Iraq and Afghanistan and said there wasn't enough evidence to associate pit exposure to respiratory diseases. I just want to hear your quick response to that, Lieutenant Colonel.
Well, you know, you can play games. I can tell you when you do your sampling, if you put in the burn pit, the stuff that's supposed to be burned like cardboard and stuff like that and take your air sampling, then your results are going to be better. But if you wait until they throw hazardous waste and oil and pollutants that are hazardous, and then you do air sampling, you're going to get some different results. So, you know, I've done a lot of air sampling in my day. I know how it's done. And so, you know, you can say, well, we got a good result. Well, that doesn't mean that you're doing the right thing. Yeah. It just means that you maybe sampled when they were burning the right stuff or less hazardous stuff. But, you know.
Right. You know, and then when you pointed out what you first wondered, is this even legal? I would say that we know in the United States, open air pit burning of things like batteries, in fact, not legal, but it was happening on U.S. bases in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. So, Lieutenant Colonel Brewer, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring Megan Stack into the program. She is a writer with the New York Times Magazine and wrote a terrific story called U.S. Soldiers Came Home Sick and the Government Denied It Was Responsible. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Megan, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first of all, I actually would love to take a minute to explore with you who was doing this burning, because when we say the military, it is a vast, vast, vast organization. And of course, we also know that particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan, for a lot of logistical, for a lot of work was done by contractors. So help us suss that out.
Yeah, well, a lot of the burn pits were actually run by KBR, the military contracting company, the defense contracting company. They had gotten a sort of series of logistical contracts to take care of things that the military didn't really have the staff to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. And under the logistical contracts, part of that was waste disposal. So I kind of went back and forth about whether it was they actually ran most of the burn pits. Some people say they did. We never totally pinned that down, so we can say safely that many of them were run by KBR. And I think there's a lot of people say most. So, yeah, it was KBR.
So the Defense Department sent us answers to some questions, and I'm going to presume they gave you similar answers, right? We asked why were they even used? Why were burn pits used? And they said that open-air burn pits are used during contingency operations only in circumstances for which the combatant commander determines no alternative disposal method is feasible. Now, what I'm curious about is, we were spending hundreds of billions of dollars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, on those very contractors, KBR, that you're talking about. They made a lot of things possible, especially on base in both of those countries, but they couldn't get, you know, proper incineration facilities built. Do you have any more information about that, Megan?
I don't think there was ever, at that time, like after sort of the invasion of Afghanistan and in the early years of the Iraq invasion, I don't believe there was really any discussion of that. I don't think it just wasn't, you know, it was part of the plan going in that for the most part, burn pits would be used. There wasn't any other allowance made for any kind of disposal. And of course, like these were countries that the U.S. military was holding by hostile occupation. So there was a thought that there, you know, the security requirements made it better to burn any trash on the base rather than take the risk of going, you know, outside the wire out into kind of uncontrolled territory where you might end up engaging, getting into some kind of a gunfight or, you know, hitting an improvised explosive device on the road. So, you know, I just don't think, I think it took years before anybody sort of in a position of power began to think seriously about the idea that maybe this wasn't the thing to do, because, you know, the military has used burn pits for a long time. They were used in the Balkans. They were used in the first Gulf War. You know, they're kind of the fact that they became so much bigger and more prevalent in the post September 11th wars. I don't think that anybody really thought through that whole, you know, arc.
Yeah. So the duration that the military has been using the burn pits, I mean, you just mentioned the Balkans and even previous to that. It's very fascinating because we also, again, ask the Pentagon when, this was the question we emailed them, when did the U.S. military first start using burn pits? And the answer they gave us, Megan, was, quote, "We do not have data available prior to 2001, period.
Oh, well, that's, I mean, I know people who served in the Balkans who've told me about, you know, having burn pits. So, you know, and they've been used in other countries as well. They, you know, I think some people will say, if you look at the history of burning trash, it's a very old military thing to do. But, you know, I think it's one thing to talk about this sort of like ancient, you know, burning a little bag of trash on the side of the road, and quite another thing to build, you know, to sort of dig a hole as big as a football field and fill it with, you know, industrial medical waste and cover it with jet fuel and then set it on fire. Like, that's a totally different scale of operation and pollution.
Yeah. Lieutenant Colonel Brewer, quick question for you. I mean, the jet fuel part is also important to understand here, because burning jet fuel, if I understand correctly, the fuel in and of itself, if you're, is putting what? Benzene
and things
Absolutely. Like that in the air. Tell me more about that.
Well, yeah, it causes a problem. But I mean, when you're putting it in, it's like burning leaves in your yard when it smolders. I mean, so they throw the jet fuel on it to get it hotter to burn, which is the whole one of the purpose of the incinerator, is to get the fire hotter so it doesn't smolder and have a lot of smoke. The other thing on the incinerator, you get a stack on it to get it up and get it away from the troops so they're not breathing these fumes. And, you know, but I mean, they did that because this stuff doesn't burn well. So you keep throwing, you know, diesel fuel and jet fuel on it to get it to burn. That's what they did.
Yeah. Well, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Brewer with us from Albany, Georgia today. Again, in 2005, he was actually sent by the Pentagon to Iraq as an environmental officer to examine conditions on U.S. Military bases there, and wasn't necessarily listened to when he reported back to the Pentagon on what he found. Lieutenant Colonel Brewer, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, I want to bring in Leroy Torres into the conversation now. He joins us from Robstown, Texas. He's a retired Army captain, served for 23 years, including in Iraq from 2007 to 2008. And he and his wife founded the nonprofit Burn Pits 360 that seeks to help other vets and families dealing with burn pit exposure. Captain Torres, welcome to you.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for having me on today.
So first of all, you know, I read that statement that we received from the Pentagon saying, well, they don't have any data on burn pit usage from prior to 2001. It reminded me of the fact that, for example, regarding Agent Orange, it took the government half a century to acknowledge the effects on soldiers and civilians as well, with the use of Agent Orange in Southeast Asia. So does it sound familiar to you, what you're hearing?
Absolutely, it does. You know, as I was hearing Colonel Brewer speak, and I remember being in Iraq in 2007 and just noticing the stench of the burn pit. But it just took me back to before I left the base, that they handed me a memorandum from Lieutenant Colonel Curtis, where it an identified burn pit was a hazard. And it's just, yeah, it's sickening just to think that, you know, there was an article that was published last year. I believe it was TerraCop, where the VA knew that Afghanistan and Iraq was going to have an issue with toxic exposure issues on veterans.
Mm. So how has this had an impact on you?
The exposure, the issue has had a tremendous impact to the point not only has affected my health, but it cost me two careers. You know, I lost my, of course, my military, they medically boarded me here in 2013, as well as the Department of Public Safety forced me to resign from my position because of my conditions associated with toxic exposure.
And do you mind telling me a little bit more about those conditions? I'm seeing here that you have been diagnosed with toxic brain injury.
That's correct. Well, going back to 2010, I was after a lung biopsy that I had at Vanderbilt University Hospital. I've seen Dr. Miller, and the lung biopsy revealed that I had constrictive bronchiolitis with fibrosis. And here, 8 years later, in 2018, I was diagnosed with a toxic encephalopathy, which is a toxic brain injury, which compromises my cognitive abilities, my spatial memory, short-term memory issues, massive cluster headaches that now I use supplemental oxygen to ease the pain.
Well, Captain Torres, stand by for just a second because we have to take this quick break. And Megan, hang on as well. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, for example, the long years of advocacy that Leroy Torres and other veterans have been engaging in to expand coverage for health effects due to burn pits and what may be changing now, these many years later. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are talking about burn pits and the changes going on right now in Capitol Hill and at the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs regarding expanding coverage to veterans who have suffered health effects due to those burn pits. I'm joined today by Leroy Torres. He's a retired Army captain and founder of Burn Pits 360, an advocacy group that's worked for years to help veterans and their families dealing with burn pit exposure. Megan Stack also joins us as well, a writer with the New York Times Magazine who's written extensively about this issue. And we're getting a ton of response online about burn pits. For example, Dr. Deborah Lynn says, heartbroken for my military sisters and brothers, but let's not forget the thousands of United States government civilians assigned near those pits, lived next to them for 2.5 years in Afghanistan. A lot of state USAID and CIA folks exposed too. Who cares for us? She asks. And Renee Shapiro points out, it's not only the troops that were exposed, but the air was polluted for civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's an ongoing environmental disaster created by our military. And on that point, Dorna, who called us from Columbus, Ohio, has an even stronger way of putting it.
All of the concern is directed to the American mercenaries who went off voluntarily to fight an illegal war and came back with naturally the consequences of their actions imprinted upon their own health. Meanwhile, the people of Afghanistan suffer from the same ecological and health consequences. And yet, There is absolutely no sympathy from the American media. This is a shame. This is an absolutely cruel erasure of the people who will live with the consequences of American occupation for generations.
That's Dorna from Columbus, Ohio, about the civilian impact on the people of Afghanistan and Iraq of those burn pits as well. Megan Steck, for our purposes today, though, we are focusing on the changes that are happening regarding covering and assisting veterans. But tell me a little bit more about what you found, about why the VA really rejected so many requests for coverage for so many years. I mean, they've been telling us it's because veterans simply couldn't connect the burn pit exposure to their health issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a circular thing. I should say, first of all, that I did spend a lot of time sort of trying to communicate with the VA. I spoke with multiple people at the VA, former VA people on the record, off the record, current VA people, trying to just kind of build out a better understanding of the history of burn pits in the VA and how, you know, why so many claims were rejected for so long, and why now there has been seemingly a change of heart. And I have to say, I couldn't really get anybody to sort of stand up and kind of take ownership of the entire policy, or to sort of explain, okay, we used to look at it this way, and then this changed, and now we see it that way. Hmm. So, I mean, it's very, you know, this is all kind of there. It's a very muddy picture, and a lot of it is, you know, you can only sort of go by what different people tell you. I do know that the VA itself told Congress that between 2007 and 2020, they rejected 78% of claims that mentioned burn pits. So that's a huge rejection rate. They would always say, and had on their website, in fact, for a very long time, and this is famous. When you, I'm sure, you know, Leroy Torres knows this. If you talk to anybody who has tried to fight for burn pit compensations and coverage, this was like an infamous thing. On their website, it said, "Research does not show evidence of long-term health problems from exposure to burn pits," like full stop. So that was their position for a long time. But the thing that complicates that picture is that I interviewed multiple people within the VA who described to me ways that the VA, while asserting publicly that there wasn't enough research to connect the health problems to the burn pits, were simultaneously, according to multiple people that I spoke with who went on the record, and you can read the piece on the website, mm-hmm. Said that their work was suppressed, that they were that their work was censored, that they were threatened against coming out and saying that these health links existed, and in some cases that they were retaliated against. So the fact that that was going on at the same time that the VA was publicly asserting that they simply couldn't, we can't give you money for that. We can't cover that because there's just no evidence that it's linked to the burn pits, is extremely troubling.
Yeah. Captain Torres, you must have run up against that same brick wall in your many years of trying to advocate here. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, absolutely. I remember going back to 2010 when the department decided to send me home, August of 2010. And here I was at the war-related illness injury center there in D.C. The fall of 2010. And I was inpatient for about 4 days. And at the end of my assessment, they said, well, there is something wrong with you, but it's not what you think it is. It's for some unknown ideology that was causing my shortness of breath. But that's what led us into like several months of a journey, just trying to seek answers for the issue that I was experiencing with my respiratory condition. And not until, of course, we saw Dr. Miller, and that was discovered.
Yeah. And Dr. Miller, by the mentioned in your reporting, Megan, as well, you know, for this is a key problem with toxins and the body, that regardless of where a person was exposed to various toxins, it actually has been historically difficult to connect that particular toxin exposure to the negative health, to say it like it directly caused it. So that's a challenge everywhere. But I think in the case, and Captain Torres, this is for you here, in the case of veterans, what really perplexes me is for so many years, it wasn't even so much that, like, okay, well, you can't say 100% that the burn pit smoke is what caused your illnesses. But this was something that definitely happened very soon after your service. So shouldn't that be enough for the VA to say, we will cover your health care needs? That's the part that I don't really get.
You know, and absolutely, this should be an indicator that there's definitely something wrong. You said in my case, as soon as I returned from Iraq, I was in the emergency room within 3 weeks with a upper respiratory infection, but I was already having issues a month after I was in Iraq. So in my investigative mind, since I was in my civilian job, I started, you know, doing my homework and, you know, asking the questions. And of course, at times, just like Colonel Brewer said, it's not like I stayed in my lane, that the ridden of the waste is taken care of by contractors. But it's things like that that it's just disgusting, and it's heart-wrenching, because someone that goes, is deployed with, you know, in great health, and then returns with having these massive amounts of doctor visits is definitely an indicator.
Yeah. Megan Stack, Captain Torres and his group Burn Pits 360 and others have been trying for years to really get this issue front and center in the minds of the president and Congress. He's even testified before Congress on this. Just frankly, is it because Captain Torres and Burn Pits 360 enlisted the help of actor and comedian John Stewart that put a lot of public focus on this that may have turned that is that the thing that's helped sort of make Congress and the Department of Veterans Affairs move forward a little? I mean, is it as just sort of down and dirty as that kind of politics?
I mean, it certainly did look that way. It seemed like, you know, Burn Pits 360 and, you know, some of the survivors and the sick veterans have been out there for many years having meetings, trying to draw attention to these questions and these issues. Researchers have been talking about this, people like Colonel Brewer. I mean, these people have been talking for a long time in public. There have been many stories about this over the years. It's not a new issue. But it does seem that once John Stewart sort of, you know, John Stewart and his lobbying partner, John Feal, who was, you know, representing the 9/11 first responders, they had very successfully used sort of Stewart's platform and the kind of media attention that he can command to pretty much, I think it's fair to say that he shamed lawmakers into voting to cover the health care of the 9/11 first responders. And that took years. They fought that battle for a long time, very tirelessly. And when that was finally done, I know they sort of looked around to see what they would do next. And they connected with the Torres family. It seemed like once they took up the cause, it did get everybody moving in Washington in a very dramatic way.
Right.
But there's also, I mean, we should say, I think when I was reporting the piece, it was mostly Stewart, but also President Biden has become very active in this issue in recent months in particular. And that was always the hope that he would do that, because people knew for a long time going into this that he had said publicly that he believed that his son had died because of burn pits. So there was always a lot of hope on the part of the burn pit activists that once he got into office, he would do something.
His son, Beau Biden, who died of brain cancer.
Correct.
Yeah, Captain Torres, I know that you probably want to add to this. Go ahead.
Yes, Magna, and just hearing Megan, it's just I see things as you try to voice the issue. It was something that was just swept under the rug for years. And just sitting here and listening to the conversation today, I was reminded of Joe Hickman's book, The Burn Pits, The Poisoning of America's Soldiers, how his work was, you know, attempted to censor it as well. I know all the military bases was that book was banned. It could not be sold in military bases because it was a type of a whistleblower issue. So it's something that definitely it hits at the core of veterans, those have honored the oath and go and defend the nation. But when they return, it's just like President Biden said, it shouldn't be something that we have to ask for healthcare. It's something that should be offered to everyone across the board.
Mm. So let's talk about what has happened just in the past week, for example. The House passed the so-called PACT Act. It's a bill that aims to boost healthcare services and disability benefits for veterans exposed to burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we'll get to sort of who voted how here. But Captain Torres, do you see the PACT Act as a as an adequate step forward, or is there still more to go?
It's definitely an adequate step forward, but there's more to go, you know. But definitely the Honoring Our PACT Act, it's of course, a bill that's going to set the pathway for specialized health care for veterans for the 23 conditions. But it's something that there's still work ahead, for sure.
Yeah. So just to be clear, and you mentioned it just there, just right. The Honoring Our PACT Act says that it would establish a presumption of service connection, right, rather than a presumption of not connection for 23 respiratory illnesses and cancers. And that is for veterans who apply for benefits within 10 years of their service. Is that right, Captain Torres?
That's on the other bill.
That's the one other bill.
On the South, yes.
Okay, good.
Which is ours, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to get that straight here. Well, listen, so we also should talk about the resistance to the Honoring Our PACT Act, because it did pass the House last week, 256 to 174. 36 Republicans only voted in favor of the bill, so 174 voted against the bill. And Representative Marionette Miller Meeks of Iowa was one who voted against. And here she is speaking in opposition on the House floor earlier this month.
If the PACT Act were enacted, VA estimates the disability claims backlog could reach over 1.5 million claims by the end of fiscal year 2023. That's more than double the height of the backlog in 2013. If veterans were waiting years for their benefits 9 years ago, imagine how long they would have to wait today for a backlog that is more than two times the size it was then.
And the representative also talked about the cost of the act, $300 billion over 10 years. And she said, veterans are taxpayers too. Megan Stack, what do you think about what has happened on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think it's predictable. I mean, this is going to be really expensive. It's no joke. But I also, you know, the opposite argument that you'll hear from the people who are supporting it is, this is the cost of the war. And if you don't want to pay this cost, then maybe don't have the war. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. you can't sort of come back after and say, we're just not going to honor our obligation to the veterans who fought in these wars because it's just cost too much. You know, I think it's entirely predictable. I think that is why, perhaps, that's certainly a strong theory as to why this has all taken so long in the first place. And I think that is why people like John Stewart are the only ones who are really able to break through some of this stuff, because at the end of the day, people are scared. They don't want to be shamed or to be seen to not be supporting the veterans and not be supporting the troops. And so if they feel like there may be negative publicity, then that may sort of encourage them to support something like this. But, you know, there certainly will be enormous resistance.
Yeah. Well, you know, Captain Torres, we only got a couple seconds left. And that price tag on the act, that $300 billion roughly over 10 years, that means on average $30 billion a year. I also note that Congress just passed a $1.5 trillion spending bill, right? $740 billion of which is for the Department of Defense, just for this year alone. So spending doesn't seem to be a problem. I just want to give you 10 more seconds to just give us your last thoughts today, Captain Torres.
You know, Magna, I know that we honored our oath to serve this nation, and we signed a blank check, and we expect the same in return from members of Congress to do your part and honor your oath and support the cost of war, what war has done to us.
Well, Leroy Torres, retired Army captain, served for 23 years, co-founder of Burn Pits 360. Thank you so much for joining us. And Megan Stack with the New York Times, thank you so much for joining us and your reporting as well. We have links to Megan's reporting at onpointradio.org and reporting from other organizations as well, including The War Horse. It's been doing a lot of this for many years, so check it out. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.